May it please the court. My name is Todd Bulgey, and I'm here on behalf of Russell Stevenson, who was employed by Holland Binkley Company for a period of time before he was terminated under what I would suggest are circumstances other than what Holland Binkley would have this court believe. Mr. Stevenson, during his time with Holland Binkley, had several workers' compensation cases, and we believe that it was his enforcement of his rights under the workers' compensation law that were the cause of his termination in direct violation of Section 287.780 of the Missouri Revised Statutes. Mr. Stevenson was, during the course of his negotiation of the settlement of his workers' compensation cases, Mr. Stevenson was approached by Holland Binkley and asked if he would accept a termination of his employment as a condition whereby they would provide him some more money in settlement of his workers' compensation cases. When that offer was withdrawn by Holland Binkley upon a realization that you can't do that under Section 287.780, you can't condition settlement of the comp case on a separation agreement, Mr. Stevenson subsequently settled his case and then a very short time later was terminated by Holland Binkley. The employer claims that the reason for the termination was that Mr. Stevenson was making phone calls during company time over the course of a two-month period immediately prior to his termination. And this is some three or four months after, only a couple of months after he settled his workers' compensation case, 4 or 5 months after the time when the offer was made to him that if he would take more money, he could be.
Now, were there incident reports filed? Did the supervisor say, you're on a personal call?
No, there were.
I'm going to cite you.
No, Your Honor.
Either before or after the settlement.
No, Your Honor. What happened was Mr. Stevenson was approached in early July by his supervisor and told and informed at that time that during what they said was a check of phone records, there was an anomaly that they wanted to discuss with him, which, as it turns out, were the phone calls that he had been making to his wife. And at that time, they then suspended him without pay, and they suspended him pending termination and then terminated him shortly thereafter. So there was no warning. There was nothing that happened prior to. There was no notice given to him of a problem, and he was not notified of something that he needed to correct. He was just terminated after the suspension.
The length of time between the settlement and the firing was 8 months in this case, and your opponent says that there are cases that say 7 months is too long a period of time between these two connections. Could you respond to that?
Well, I don't think there's any set rules about the length of time. I think time is something, the cases say that time, the length of time is something that can be relevant in analyzing the motives behind a termination. And in this case, given what was involved with this particular incident where he was being told, listen, we want you out of here. If we pay you more money, will you leave to settle your comp case? I think it's relevant regardless. Obviously, if it was 10 years prior, then maybe that's an issue, a bigger issue. But I think given that it was within a year, and actually the letter indicating the withdrawal or indicating that the Holland Binkley could not do this type of transaction where they offer to pay more money in exchange for a termination, I believe was in February of the year that he was terminated, and he was terminated in July. So that offer was actually out there about 5 months prior to when he was terminated. The time frame is fairly short.
What's your client's evidence that a statement was made to him after he actually settled the claim about the fact that he would be fired? Wasn't there some evidence that subsequent to the settlement he was told?
That's correct, Your Honor. Subsequent to the settlement, one of his supervisors approached him at work, and this was just through his testimony at his deposition, that he stated that the supervisor threatened his job.
But what did he say was said then?
He says that the supervisor told him that that I believe it was something to the effect of, we're going to get you, or we're going to get you out of here, or something to that effect.
They didn't explicitly refer to the work comp, but he interpreted it as referring to
That's correct, because I think the timing was quite close within a few weeks the timing of when, at the most, of when this statement was said to him and when he settled his workers' compensation claim.
So. You didn't raise the exclusive causation issue in the trial court. Is that something that's preserved for this court to look at?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the issue there is that this all goes to the notion of causation. And the causation issue I did raise in my original brief in the appellate court, and in fact it's the entire basis of my appeal in the appellate court, that the causation standard that's being proposed by Holland Binkley is not, and that was used by the judge in the trial court and I guess used by the Court of Appeals in the Eastern District, it's not the proper, what those cases were not used properly as opposed on this particular case.
You have two different arguments. One is, regardless of exclusive causation, you can't give a pretextual reason after the fact to cover up an improper reason.
Correct.
And that he wouldn't have been fired for the phone call, so the only reason he was really fired, and that was used as a pretext, was his work comp claim. But you also make a second argument in this court, which I don't believe you raised in the trial court, and so we review for error, which is that regardless whether there was a dual cause, it doesn't matter because exclusive causation is improper. And I'm wondering if that's really before us on this appeal.
Judge, I think it's a natural extension, though, of the argument that I made. I think it's merely an embellishment or a further example of what the situation is with the causation standard. Quite frankly, I'm not sure that the causation standard, even though it's denominated as exclusive causation, the way the cases have developed, there's exclusive causation is really not the right word to describe how these cases are analyzed because, as in this case, there are multiple stated reasons as to why the termination occurred. And if an employer can state a reason, but an employee can show or can attempt to show that that reason is a pretext, there's the exclusivity isn't really the right name for that. If it was a straight exclusive causation, all the employer would have to do is say, I fired you for a non-discriminatory reason,
period. Well,
if
that's why you were fired, but you said here that is not, in fact, why he was fired. He was fired because of his work comp.
That's correct. But if the point is, I'm sorry, Judge,
no,
go ahead.
That's fine.
That's right. No, what I'm saying is, in this case, Mr. Stevens, there is a proffered reason that on its face is non-discriminatory. But our position is that that's a pretextual reason, that's not the real reason that he was fired. The real reason that he was fired was because he enforced his workers' compensation rights, as shown by the various pieces of evidence that I pointed out to the trial court.
So are you urging us not to adopt contributory or exclusive language, but pretextual language?
Well, I think that the contributing factor test solves all of these problems. Solves all of these problems, and it solves all of this confusion. You don't have to be talking about pretext anymore, and you can get right into putting the appropriate level of teeth back into a statute that, quite frankly, it's being used more as a shield than as the affirmative cause of action that it's supposed to be. So I think I would advocate that the contributing factor test be used, but I think regardless of whether this court adopts that test, under the standard as it is currently put forth by the case law, my client squarely fits within the pretext cases and should be allowed to present his case to the jury and let the jury decide who it is that they, which reason they believe is the reason for the termination.
So you're saying we don't even have to get to the contributing factor exclusive issue?
I don't believe you do have to get to it. I think that's right. I think you can decide this case and reverse the summary judgment based upon the facts and the standard the way that it has developed. But I think this whole discussion just shows the need for the contributing factor test because all of this discussion of an exclusive causation, except if there's a pretext, except if the reason offered by the employer is a pretext. Well, that's not really exclusive causation then. It's something different, and I think to avoid all that confusion and to bring everything together, given what's happened with the 2005 amendment to the statute, given what's happened, what this court has done recently with the public policy cases, there's no reason to treat public policy exception cases differently from these types of cases. They're all discrimination cases of one form or another. There's nothing distinguishing about them that I can see. It seems like some uniformity in how these cases are decided and applied would make some sense. And to do that, then I would think that this court should adopt the contributing factor test. I will yield the rest of my time to my opponent and take any questions you have after he's done. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. Brian Kammer for Respondent Holland Binkley. Let me begin by briefly noting that I believe there's a significant procedure obstacle in this case that I think, Judge Stith, you hit the nail on the head. And that's that the first time that the issue over the proper standard to be applied in this case was raised was not at the trial court level, was not at the Court of Appeals level, but in the substitute briefs to this court. And Rule 8308 says clearly that the substitute brief shall not alter the basis of any claim that was raised in the Court of Appeals brief. As recently as 2005 in Lane versus Linsmeyer, this court refused to consider an argument that was raised for the first time before this court. Now, in this case, not only was the issue over the proper standard not raised below, but it was actually conceded to by appellant at both the trial court level, at the appellate level, and indeed in the request to transfer to this case. The appellant admitted that in order to prevail, he has to prove an exclusive causal connection.
Didn't we decide a case in the interim, though, and does that affect whether or not it's appropriate for us to look at the application of exclusive causation in the work comp context, because only after the briefing in the trial court and court of appeals did this court, for the first time, address the public policy exceptions and say exclusive causation is not required?
Sure. And you didn't, and this court did in February of 2010 in the Pepos case. But in order to be properly raised, as it was in the Pepos case, they still have to raise that issue below, because the facts of the Pepos case show that there were proper objections below saying, hey, we don't think this is the proper standard. We don't think it's a motivating factor. We think it should be contributing factor.
Should this court reverse on the alternative ground raised by opposing counsel, and should the case be remanded, this issue will arise on remand. Is it appropriate for us to address it to give guidance to the court on remand?
I don't believe so, because I think that on remand the record will be what the record is and the case will go from there. But, you know, on the pretext
issue. But then the issue of whether or not you have to submit based on exclusive causation and work comp cases will arise on remand in light of the fact that it's arisen here. It's bound to.
Sure. It would arise if this case goes back on the pretext issue. But in order to be proper at this point in time, it had to be raised properly before. And if this case goes back on pretext and if it's properly raised at that time, well, then we could be back up here several months after the fact. Okay. But at this point in time, the issue just wasn't properly raised. And for a bunch of reasons that I'm going to get into a couple minutes later, I don't think the case should be reversed on pretext basis. So, again, the appellant has conceded, and indeed in his brief to the Court of Appeals, and I quote, that in order to prevail in his claim, he has to prove an exclusive causal relationship between Mr. Stevenson's actions and Defendant Holland's actions. That's from the appellant's brief. That's not from respondent's brief. So the issue has been conceded to in this case. And it's simply unfair to my client and blatantly contradictory to Rule 8308 for this court to even consider this issue in this case. And for that reason, I suggest that the appropriate outcome in this case is to retransfer the case to the Court of Appeals if, in fact, the exclusive causation issue was the only issue that this court wanted to consider. Now, Judge Stith, you also raised the pretext issue. And there's a couple things I want to point out on pretext. Is first of all, the law is very clear, abundantly clear, that the plaintiff is the party that bears the burden of establishing pretext. That's the Williams versus Transstate Airlines case from 2009. The second thing is the law is also very clear that in order for the pretext analysis to apply, the person to whom you're being compared to has to be similarly situated in all relevant.
Why do you have to compare yourself to someone to show it's a pretext? They said you know, they said, you said you were going to get rid of me. I believe that related to the work comp, and then you did get rid of me. You tried to get rid of me during the work comp time. You come back and say he made all these phone calls over 2 months. Why isn't that a classic jury question?
Sure. Here's how I analyze the pretext issue in the context of the workers' comp under the exclusive causation issue. As soon as Mr. Stevenson admitted in his deposition that I violated company policy, I violated the handbook, and I'll read to you the exact quote from the deposition. But I asked Mr. Stevenson, quote, and you would agree that those personal calls would be in violation of that handbook? Answer, most certainly they would be. So there's no dispute that he admits to misconduct here. Now, once he admits to misconduct, I have a valid reason for discharge.
Well, You could have a valid reason for discharge. He says that's not, in fact, why, and that's shown by the fact that phone calls are specifically listed as something subject to multiple levels of notice and grievance before you're fired, yet he was treated under a different provision, which calls for immediate firing for emergency and safety reasons and so forth. I mean, I understand your arguments, but what you're asking us to resolve that and decide it wasn't really a pretext. Seems to me. Why aren't you doing that?
Sure, I'll answer that in several parts. First of all, what Mr. Stevenson really does is disagrees with the level of discipline that was imposed. And that's my management discretion to impose whatever level of discipline I view necessary. You know, this court does not sit as a super personnel department to review the decisions of management. Now, under the exclusive causation standard, once the plaintiff admits to misconduct, stop there. At that point in time, I've got a plaintiff who admitted to violating company policy. So there's no dispute that we violated company policy. What Mr. Stevenson disagrees with is he says, well, that's not the real reason. I believe it's all this other stuff. Well, if that's what he's claiming, he has to go one step further, and he has to prove, here's all these other people that engage in similar.
Why does he have to do, I mean, that would certainly make a stronger case, but why does he have to do that?
Because in order for pretext analysis to apply.
I'm asking, what's the case that says that? You have to have comparative, you have to have multiple people and show a disparate treatment in order to show pretext.
Sure, that's Buckhite versus Missouri Commission on Human Rights, a 2007 case from the Western District.
And what does it say? It says it's required?
Yes, it says that the other part, you have to, in order for a pretext analysis to apply, you have to compare the plaintiff to someone else. Because again, under exclusive causation, as soon as a plaintiff admits to engaging in misconduct, the workers' comp can't be the exclusive cause of his discharge.
But it can be if that's in fact the only reason you discharged him.
But it's not as soon as I get him to admit that he engaged in misconduct.
Are you sure about that? I mean, let me, one of the things, a lot of times we have negligence, mm-hmm. but no causation. Okay? I did something wrong, but it didn't hurt you. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't it be here that, yes, they have him violating a company policy, but that's not why they fired him? They wouldn't have fired him for that, without regard to anybody else. You haven't proved causation from the act violating the rule to the determination to let him go.
Well, I think the law in the state has always been that if I have a valid and non-pretextual reason for discharge, in this case, the admitted and repeated violations of company policy against personal use. At that point in time, I have just cause for termination. You violated company policy. The rules are in the handbook. You admitted receiving the handbook. You violated it. I can terminate you for that.
I agree with you. You have just cause for that.
Correct.
But is that why you did it? Isn't the question, isn't there one more level of analysis here? Is that any part of your decision?
Well, under the exclusive causal standard, once the plaintiff admits to engaging in misconduct, at that point in time, there cannot be an exclusive causal connection because I've got admitted misconduct.
Well then, whether or not other people were fired for that or not is irrelevant too, because you're saying as soon as you have just cause, and that is what the Court of Appeals held. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why is that correct? That you're saying as soon as you have a reason, that's sufficient, and then you wouldn't really matter if there were 20 other people who did the same thing who you didn't fire, because under your analysis, it still was a reason, so it's not a
solution. Well, at that point, I have a reason. But then under the pretext analysis, if he can show that effectively he was singled out for this discipline and that in cases A, B, C, D, and F, I didn't discharge
but
this person.
But can he show his retaliation through the conduct of the employer? If he can show that he has evidence that the employer told the supervisor, this guy's costing me too much money, get rid of him. Do whatever you have to do to get rid of him. And then they find the telephone. Isn't there some aspect of this that reflects back on the employer's motive in firing him?
Under the exclusive causation standard, no. Because, again, as soon as I have a valid reason, this violation of company policy, unless and until the plaintiff can show that you're singling me out, you didn't discipline cases A, B, C, D, and F in the same way for the same conduct that I engaged in, then under the exclusive causation standard, I can terminate. Okay.
Counsel, assuming, because I'm not familiar with that case, but assuming that Court of Appeals case holds that, tell me why it's correct. I mean, that's a type of evidence. Why isn't some other evidence that shows it's pretextual equally valid way to prove it? Is there any case from this court that says you can only prove pretext in one manner?
Well, I think the cases from this court are the Hansen case.
That may be the best way, of course. But
the cases from this court are the Hansen case and the Crabtree case. Both, as I refer to in my brief, strikes one and two on
but
the.
But those are just exclusive causation. I'm dealing with the issue of pretext, and you're saying to prove pretext, you have to prove disparate treatment. And I'm not familiar with any case from this court that states that.
Well, again, I think the Buckeye case does, but that's
you said
the
Court
that's
of Appeals case. Right.
Right, admittedly. But what that says.
I'm wondering where that would come from, though. I mean, if the issue, that's certainly a great way to prove pretext, but and it may be really hard to prove it without that. But where is. What would be the basis of a rule that says that's the only way you can do it?
Well, I think the Buckeye case drew from federal law that's analogous in
McDonnell Douglas, basically. And but, I mean, is it. Well, we. Because our. Go ahead.
Well, again, what Buckeye says is in order to show disparate treatment, in order to show pretext, the plaintiff needs to be similarly situated in all relevant aspects. And what that means is you have to deal with the same supervisor, subject to the same standards, engaged in the same misconduct without any mitigating or aggravating
circumstances. And is there anything in Missouri law that requires us to follow that standard?
I believe yes, because we've got Missouri law from this court under Crabtree and Hansen that say we have an exclusive causal standard that applies in these workers' compensation retaliation cases. And under that exclusive causal standard, if I have cause, if I have a violation of company policy, admitted violation of company policy, then that violation is the reason for discharge. It can't possibly be the exclusive cause for these exercise of the workers' compensation rights. So once
like
we get,
you're saying there's clear, you need clear convincing evidence or something like, I mean, you're saying you have a higher burden because of the proven pretext because of exclusive causation. But why would,
Well, I think the higher burden comes in the form of the exclusive causation standard, which has been the law in the state for a quarter century now. But once you get past the exclusive causation standard, I think you do need to show pretext by showing I dealt with all these other employees differently than I dealt with you. So if Mr. Stevenson would have presented evidence that, hey, all these other employees were dealt with in a different fashion for like or similar conduct, then he could potentially go to a jury. But he didn't because, you know, nowhere in the record is there any facts to support his unsubstantiated claims of pretext. You know, for instance, who was the employee that was allegedly treated differently? I still don't know that person's name. Was any management official aware of any alleged misconduct by these other employees? You know, sometimes employees get away with it. You have to be caught in order to be possibly subject to discipline. Number three, were any of these other employees, was the misconduct before or after the company revised its handbook? They have to be subject to the same standards. Number four, were any of these alleged other employees that engaged in this misconduct, was it a single instance of misconduct? Did they just pick up the phone, make a 10-second phone call? Or did they do this repeatedly over the course of a month and a half? And let's keep in mind that, you know, it's not as though Mr. Stevenson came to management and said, hey, guys, I've got a sick wife at home. Can you guys work with me? He did this surreptitiously, and then he got caught. And he admits that, hey, I had two work breaks, 15 minutes each, and I have a 30-minute lunch where I could have made those personal phone calls. But you know what? I chose not to. I took my break. I took my lunch. Then I came back to work when I'm clocked in on the clock, supposed to be at my workstation working. And that's when I decided, hey, go call my wife. Moreover, during his deposition, he admitted, I used the phone for personal reasons all the time. It wasn't just in connection with my wife's sickness. I did it before she got sick. I just have the ability to use the phone. I can just do that. I'm not subject to the rules of the handbook. You know, he almost felt an entitlement, I got the sense, that I can just use the phone whenever I want to. And I think a very significant piece of testimony in this case was from his shop steward, his union shop steward, the very party that was advocating on his behalf to try and get his job back throughout the grievance process, because he's a member of the labor union. We went through the grievance process. His urine shop steward says, you know what? I believe they have just cause to terminate him. I tried to get the company to go easy on him, you know, tried to get him to essentially throw himself at the mercy of the company, you know, give this guy another chance, he's a good guy, this and that, but he wouldn't do it. He said, I have a right to use that phone. And the shop steward says, you know what, we've got rules in this workplace. You violate the rules, you do so at your peril. So, you know, I think this is a classic example of an employee that surreptitiously was breaking the rules, got caught, and now refuses to take responsibility for his actions, wants to blame it on all these other things. Well, you know what, you violated the rules. You know, you do the crime, you got to do the time. And that's really, I think, appropriate in this case. Thank you.
Well, I think the points that Mr. Kammerer just made are all would sound very good in his closing argument to the jury. I think that's, in fact, where those points belong. If he wants to impugn the credibility of my client, then that's something that the jury should take into consideration and decide when they're deciding whether or not the reason that Holland Binkley suggests Mr. Stevenson was terminated is the actual reason, or if Mr. Stevenson was terminated because he enforced his workers' compensation rights, which would be a clear violation of 287.780.
Let me ask you a question about this exclusive causation, the phrase itself, because it kind of relates to what Judge Price was asking your opposing counsel. If you have a number of reasons why you can fire somebody, but you don't, and then then what happens is you've got him making a worker's comp claim. Now the federal standard says something like motivating factor, and then that's when they get into pretext and all that. But even though there are the other things that he has the right to be fired for, doesn't that exclusive causation really mean something more akin to this was the motivating factor, this was the reason he was fired?
I think that's a better description of how the standard currently is than exclusive causation. And I think the problems with an exclusive
fire somebody.
You can fire them for any reason or no reason whatsoever in Missouri because it's an at-will employment state.
And well, is he an at-will employee? Because you mentioned that he has a union.
He did have a union. That's correct, Your Honor. And he did go through the union channels.
Does he have a right to grievance?
I believe he did file one, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. So,
was there a determination made in the grievance proceeding?
I believe yes, there was a determination made, and the decision of the employer was upheld. Yes. But I think that all of this discussion and this notion of what exclusive causation is, it's the same thing that apparently that I think tripped up the Eastern District, you know, and that they analyzed that Coleman versus Winning case, and they said because Mr. Stevenson admitted the underlying conduct, then he can't recover under the workers' compensation statute. Well, Coleman versus Winning doesn't say that. In fact, in Coleman versus Winning, what happened was the employer admitted that, yes, the reason that the employee admitted that, yes, the reason that the employer told me they fired me is what they told me, but that's not the actual reason they fired me. And that's the distinction that I think that gets lost here, is that there's an analysis of the pretext that is separate and distinct and is allowed under all circumstances, regardless of what the claim is of the employer.
In the grievance procedure, did the issue of the retaliation come up during the grievance procedure?
I believe it. In this particular context, where the allegations that he was fired because he filed a workers' compensation claim, did that come up? I don't believe that it did, Your Honor. No.
And who was officiating at the grievance procedure?
It would have been whoever the grievance panel was for his union. So, thank you, Your Honors.
Case taken under submission.